Welcome to this Conversations on Grung episode. Today we're talking about Georgia and its domestic turbulence of late, and the role that foreign powers play in these protests. If time permits, we'll touch on Armenian-Georgian relations and the parallels in the domestic developments. We have with us Sopo Japaridze. Welcome to the show, Sopo.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Hello and gamarjoba.
Gamarjos. Hello.
Sopo, since this is your first time on our show, please tell us a little more about yourself.
So I am a labor union head, but I've been a labor organizer for 15 years or so in the U.S. and also in Georgia. I got my start as a labor organizer in the U.S. And then I also run a podcast called Reimagining Soviet Georgia, which is mostly about Soviet Union, Soviet Georgia, and also some post-Soviet politics. I'm also a researcher and a writer, and I think of myself sort of a citizen journalist. I often feel like I have to write about things that are happening in Georgia when no one else will, or at least a certain viewpoint that I bring.
So you describe yourself as an old school socialist and a unionist. This is a fascinating profession as well as self-description. How did you arrive to such a unique position?
So I think because I grew up in the U.S., in a way, I'm thankful because I was exposed to a lot of socialist ideas, because in Georgia, it is so sort of communist phobic and socialist phobic that I would not have had a chance in some ways to learn about socialism and different kinds and tendencies and so on. And of course, because the U.S. is, you know, huge place with so many different kinds of people, you do get exposed from, you know, socialists from other countries and communists and so on. So it is, I feel very privileged to have had this chance to have met socialists and Marxists and communists in the U.S. that have taught me so much, especially from Black communist tradition. You know, mm-hmm. U.S. is where actually where I feel like I descend from. You know, my line is from Black communist tradition. So
where in the U.S. did you grow up?
In Atlanta, I lived in New York for 2 years when I was a child, and then I moved to Atlanta. Well, I didn't move. My parents did. They moved me.
How difficult is it to organize labor in Georgia? Can you give some examples of the kind of activities that this entails?
Yeah, so it's actually, it's not that it's so hard to organize workers, because workers are in constant need of help, and people have so many problems and they want to learn. We try to give them the skill sets so they can sort of learn how to organize themselves, as well as we help them to create unions, or to come under our union, but like strengthen them. I think the biggest problem really is that we have very weak laws, though people are willing. And also we have, you know, the older unions that try to retain a monopoly. And so there's a lot of tension between us and the older union. And also NGOization has really made it difficult for a union consciousness, because the NGOs provide services, and after they provide services, the people leave. And so they often will treat the union as an NGO to get a service. And once that service is done, they no longer want to be part of a larger formation. So I think that actually works against us a lot.
Right.
That's very interesting. I would think, or I would like, if I was sort of naive, I would naively think that NGOization would help unions, because that would be something that could be funded remotely. But you're saying obviously a little bit of the opposite.
Yeah. So because often the NGOs, well, there's the multiple reasons, but one of them is that the kind of legal aid NGOs that do exist, again, they are for services. So they have a very legal help. Well, that means a law already has to be made. The laws exist. You come as an individual, not as a collective usually, right? And then they may take your case to the court or teach you about legal, you know, legal rights. So your relationship after that ends. There's no desire, like there's no continuation. And also this idea that everything should be free. So like legal aid is free. And so then when you say, well, you have to pay dues, it's like you have to also be part of a union, go to meetings, also be in solidarity with other people. And you can't just come by yourself. you shouldn't just think of your individual rights, but also collective rights. And also, we should demand more than what we have as a law, because like wages are not enshrined in the law. Those are some things you have to collectively bargain for. So those things become a problem when the only way they understand help is on an individual level, free and no strings attached. You finish and you go home.
What type of unions exist in Georgia today, and how big is the concept of unionization among different groups of labor?
The unions have a really bad reputation. Like, if you ask them, like, we are like, and I don't say we because I really don't feel like I'm part of this, but generally when you ask, they have very low trust, or, you know, trust level. It's pretty low. So there's not a lot of sort of organic love for unions. Some people also think it's like outdated. They don't really understand it. They think it's like a Soviet thing and not like a modern thing. Also, the GTUC, the union that exists, the Confederation, has existed for a long time. And they claim they have like, I think, 180,000 workers, which is a really huge amount for about a million that's supposedly employed. And so if you look at like the union density, it looks really high. It's like almost like 30% or 26% or something. And you're like, wow, if I had those numbers, I could like accomplish everything. But in reality, you don't even have a minimum wage here, right? So union density generally correlates to better working conditions, not in Georgia. And so these things where it's like, what do these people do for us, right? And so they really want to see results. But also this idea that unions are big man who will solve issues for you. And so they will come to you kind of like patron, you know, like this patron system where they're like, I have this problem, can you solve it for me? And so the patron and the NGO model kind of work together because they both have a similar thing. You come and you have somebody strong do things for you and then you leave, right? And so this idea of, again, collectively in solidarity and bridging different workers and interests together is very, very difficult. And so the unions don't have a great reputation in that sense. And the unions that do exist, again, there's GTUC that has lots of different branches. And then our independent confederation has five different unions, which is us, which is healthcare and government employees, social worker union, metro cashiers, metro drivers, and cultural and scientific workers. And we have helped create, out of the five, three. Our union put all the effort in to create them. And so besides the metro workers, they were the only ones that were independent when we got there. And this is a new phase. And now there's the cinematographer union. What I've noticed is a lot of the cultural sector is unionizing. Mm-hmm. Musicians unions, it's like become kind of cool. But I also think this is a way for them. It's kind of like they run it kind of like association union. It's a very new thing. And they have very different needs than, say, government employees, right? Because they don't have work all the time. It's much more precarious and so on. And so as far as traditional unions, I would say a lot of people who work in traditional jobs are unionized or can be unionized. And there's a desire.
In the United States, unions have also been on a low and rather unpopular for the last 25, 30 years, except post-COVID, that has started turning around. I'm not entirely sure what it's attributed to, whether it's people who really need their unions or the new generation likes to work a lot more collaboratively in that sense. Do you see similar trends in Georgia?
Not really. Just recently, as I said, with the cultural feel that it's become more. But U.S. has also been, I think it's a different phenomena there, because it's first time getting like COVID checks, like kind of like blew people's mind. Unemployment, you were getting so much unemployment there that never has really been before. So it's like first time that you felt that you could have like the care of the government, you know, it's like, and this overworked culture has kind of come together to realize that working so much and the spread of sort of hating your job, you know, it's so popular, like everything. Every TikTok, Instagram, everything I pull up from the US is like, working sucks. Like, that's like so passe, you know, like mm-hmm. we're all about living life now. And so like, it's kind of amazing. Like, I'm like, wow, it's like, oh, what I've always wanted the US to be like is happening now. But when I was in the US organizing workers, it was much harder, like much harder. And you have to explain union and so on. And most people like said, no, I don't want to unionize because it's just a temporary job or this or that. You know, I love my employer and everyone's lazy who's in the union, you know? So it is really amazing to see this huge explosion. Like, US is such progressive politics in so many ways that I'm like so impressed with. Right. Georgia's already was the Georgians are generally more predisposed to like, they're socially progressive people, you know, like they're economically progressive still. Like everyone in like, the kinds of discussions you have in Georgia is not the same as you have in the US. US people will be like, you have to work hard to get what you want. And if you're poor, it's because you're like lazy, right? Like Georgians don't think like that. I rarely meet anyone in Georgia who says that you're poor because you're lazy. You know, it's like people really believe that these socioeconomic conditions are bad. And that's why people are poor and struggling. And that's why we should help each other, because it's important to rise up. It's a very different discussion than US, where you have a much more stronger ideology of why people are poor and the sort of, you know, rise up and hard work equals success. You know, people know you work hard and you don't get anywhere in Georgia. You know, it's like, it's a very different understanding.
So Paul, we have so many questions for you. So I think this is going to be a really nice long episode, but I do want to ask one more question about unions. Are you aware of any similar work being done in Armenia, and how far along is that? Do you collaborate with anyone in Armenia or even the region on this work?
Unfortunately, not. I have tried to find people in Armenia who would be doing similar work, and I have failed to find any, because I'm, contrary to other people in Georgia, I'm always trying to somehow bridge, you know, like get people interested in labor in the Caucasus and like work together, you know, but it's often like I can't find anyone from there. And again, I'm also limited because I don't know where to look very much. But like, few friends I have in Armenia, you know, are great and progressive people, but no one's really doing the labor organizing so much. I think that I had heard there was some kind of a teacher's thing a while back, years ago. But even then, I couldn't even find the contacts. So I don't know. But that would something be, if anyone's listening that's in Armenia is doing this work, please reach out. I would love to work with you and get together.
Definitely. And so post contact information will be on our website for this episode. So please do reach out. So moving on, Czech author Milan Kundera, in his The Unbearable Lightness of Being, has an interesting sentence, which I come back to frequently. He says, "The struggle of man against power is the struggle of memory against forgetting." Ironically, Kundera was referring to the Soviet domination and influence in his country, where he emphasized that remembering itself is an act of defiance and a way to remain human. Of course, when we talk about the Soviet Union, especially if you follow the emphasis of the traditional mainline historiography, there is plenty of negative developments to recall, obviously. However, your podcast, Reimagining Soviet Georgia, you say that Georgia's Soviet legacy is not so black and white. So can you tell us a little bit more? Do you believe that Georgians, and for that matter, Armenians, Ukrainians, and other Soviet peoples have a distorted memory about their common home and history?
Yeah, like Milan Kundera, I'm not a huge fan of all the anti-communists, because I feel like they never really appreciated what they had and how bad things were in the West. And also the ones that they did, they, like say Milan Kundera, or, you know, the West welcomed them and gave them so much. They don't think they realized that this wasn't like the regular treatment of everyone else that came from the communist countries. So in general, I think they're the ones that we learn from, and the stories that have been, you know, platformed, and the people, the intellectuals that have been platformed, have always been this very anti-communist, and that has shaped the view of communism. So Cold War has shaped the view, because, you know, Cold War was unfortunately accidentally won by the US because, you know, our leaders just betrayed us. So I think it's very disheartening, because people do remember a better life, and they're being told by sort of liberal hegemony that's anti-communist that they're wrong. It's like they're, every comment's like, first they look around to make sure no one hears them, or they'll be like, you may think I'm crazy, but during communism, things were actually better. It's like, this is how they all speak, but they can't, they cannot articulate it. And so like, even the other day, I was coming from another town to Tbilisi via train, and we were sitting in a train car together. It was me and three other people from different villages. It was like a young woman and an older man and sort of a middle-aged woman. And all three of them said positive things about the Soviet Union. The whole time it was all about, they all had different politics now in some way, it's like one was pro-opposition, one was pro-government, but all three of them were pro-Soviet. And the younger girl said, well, all my family loves the Soviet Union. And I said, well, why do you think that we can't talk about it? And she's like, I don't know. I've been wondering this my whole life. I don't understand why, if everybody loves the Soviet Union, why do you have to say bad things about it? It's like, because I'm like, yeah, this is exactly it. And the older man goes, it's because they're afraid of socialism. They want to bury this past. They never want to talk about it. And this woman's like, they always claimed we didn't have this during socialism, that. But I remember these roads better. I remember that they were able to pull larger cars because they had better roads. I remember having this and this and this. I remember even when so-called, like, they'll say, like, even through injustices, like something happened at work or they were punished, they actually had channels to get justice. This, right? It's like everything you have ever been told about the Soviet Union by these writers and so on, or Kundera, this very melodramatic kind of books he writes and so on. It's like an essays, right? It's like, oh, they were just so oppressed. And then you read it and it was like, that was like the one, like 1% of people felt that way. Most people did not feel this way. Most people were actually not affected by a lot of the politics like they are now. Now it's everything's politicized. Every single, like from the store to this to that, like everything's politicized all the time. And so they're exhausted by it. And supposedly democracy is supposedly good, but they haven't seen this democracy work for them. All they see is the same kind of parties duking it out, these elites having power struggles day in, day out, right? While none of them have gotten richer, better, and everything they have ever loved, like trees or, whatever, they're all being cut down through developments. They don't have free homes anymore. Almost every single person I know who has emigrated has gone because they've lost their home, or they needed to buy a house, which was free before, or they had to take a loan out because someone was sick, or they had to pay for education. All these things were free before. And full employment. Oh, so many people say, oh, they used to take you to jail if you didn't have a job. Now, no one has a job. That's just like number one thing that people always say. Yeah. And like, you'd see these men sitting outside playing dominoes or whatever they do, or drinking beer. This was never allowed. Like, they would all be working now. Like, this is the stuff that always you hear. But then dominant discourse, it's like Stalinism, death, here, and there's like this place called Sovlab. All that they do is like, here's a place where Stalin is, whatever, during Stalin period, they killed this person, and this is where they killed this person, and this is where they killed this person. And it's like all just like, if you think, just like people are just getting mass murdered all the time, like you don't know anything about the Soviet Union. It's all you think it is. And they work hard to make sure that this is the line that is kept up. Because at the end of the day, people start expanding their imagination and start being like, no, actually, there's great things about the Soviet Union, then they would start demanding them. And then people are afraid that they would lose all this like liberalism that they have been fighting for, this supposedly is a priori always better than anything communism could ever offer. Because supposedly this freedom of speech that no one seems to ever have, right, is like somehow always better, this idea, than reality of what people remember. And then they will also mock elderly people as a nostalgic, they're like computer illiterate. Of course, they're going to remember things wrongly. Like they're just really, really disrespectful, the younger generation towards the older generation. And studies have shown every year goes up and up and up the positive attitudes towards Soviet Union. It just keeps rising, despite the propaganda every day getting stronger and stronger. Even now, all these propaganda is against the Soviet Union.
So what do you remember when you think about Georgia's Soviet legacy?
Yeah, perhaps something personal. I mean, I'm very interested in what made you, obviously you were exposed to these ideas in the US, but there must be some personal past that also clicked with these ideas.
Yeah, so I actually developed as an anti-Soviet socialist in the US. I thought the Soviet Union was bad because I came, this is like the current was like Trotskyism, even maybe some Maoism, but really like sort of anti-Soviet. And that was supposed to be like, oh, Soviet Union was stopped being good after, you know, Lenin died. You know, like it was sort of like this. And so when I came back, I had accidentally going to strikes and so on in different towns, people would just be talking all the time. And I would say something, and they would say, actually, no, this is not how it was. Like, I went to visit this mining town, you know, multiple mining towns, and they were showing me all the burnt coal. It was like this thick all over the children's playground, right? And I was like, oh my God, like, how are people living? They were showing me how, like, how much of the dust of the coal was going to their homes, how much they had to sweep every day. I'm like, this is crazy. These people are getting sick from it, you know? And they would say, and I always assume for some reason, like I was like, I assumed the Soviet Union had the worst environmental policies. So I was like, oh, it must have been like, they're like, no, actually it was illegal to burn coal this close to any kind of settlement. They would have to take it all the way into the mountains. Now they don't want to pay for that. They don't want to do that. So they burn it right there. This will be totally illegal there. You know, so it was like, really? So many things like this. Or they'll say, we had extra food. This was never allowed. This was this, you know, they would never, you know, there was explosions, miners being killed. And when I started investigating, it was like, oh, 1970s, there was a mining explosion in the Soviet Union. Lots of workers died. Since then, they completely covered it up. And they said, no one is allowed to mine there because it's too dangerous. This new, like, private companies said, oh, it's easier to mine there because it was, like, easier to get or something. So they reopened it and just, like, exposed them and killed them. You know, like, so when you're like, what, really? And so then you, like, start to think, like, how come all the liberals use all the Soviet stuff to counter all the developments? All the liberals that hate communism will still use, like, oh, during the Soviet Union, you couldn't do this. And they'll say, like, you know, you're supposed to not raise your, like, have, like, buildings too high up, you know, because that's bad for this or that's bad for that. It's have enough sunlight for this. And it's like, where all this stuff coming from, right? And it's all the Soviet scholarship. And so I'm like, how can this place that worries so much about human health, right? How can this place be this bad, right? Like as you start to think, like, if everybody likes it, if they had all these things, if it seems like there's so much regulation to make sure people were safe and well-fed and, you know, and had decent quality of, like, light coming in. And so, like, how could this be this totalitarian anti-human place, right? And if workers tell me they worked less time than they do now, right? Because they always show, like, Soviet Union people are working like slaves or something. It's actually the opposite of what was happening. It's like they use capitalist propaganda in place of Soviet.
So, obviously, if you look at different time periods during the Soviet Union, things were drastically different, you know, from the 1930s, 1940s, and so forth. And yes, I do think that there is a lot of emphasis being put on the, you know, 1930s, not realizing how Soviet Union developed, especially towards the last, two decades of its existence. And similarly, I think one can bring up issues like, you know, in the West, like slavery and internment camps and so forth. So I think it's important to have the context of time period. So when you're saying that Soviet labor laws and environmental laws were good, you know, do you have an idea of when they were developed and when they improved and became a standard for, or, you know, maybe some of the, like, better examples of environmental laws and health laws and so forth?
I can't say exactly what period. I mean, I can tell you period, but I don't have enough knowledge of, like, exact, like, laws. Like, I'm studying healthcare right now, so I know a little bit more about the healthcare because I could tell you it started from the beginning. Incredible gains. So example would be, I'm looking at, like, Soviet medicine books from, like, 1939, you know, 1940. And I didn't realize, like, example, okay? I didn't realize that malaria was huge in Georgia during the Russian Empire. So there were so many people. There was even towns that are like to point of like everyone dying from malaria. So you have over 1 million people, which is a tiny place back then. I don't even know how many million people Georgians were there. Because it was, they grew up till 5. You know, now we're not back to 3.5. But, you know, so you have 1 million people with malaria. And the Soviet Union takes drastic measures of investing in public health and safety. And it's like so many different initiatives how to get rid of malaria. And they pretty much eradicate it. You know, so like you have a place where you inherit all these sick people with no homes, not very, not enough sanitation, you know, housing, so on and so on. And you're trying to build this very, very quickly to make sure that they have housing. You have to train all new nurses and doctors. And, you know, it's like even like the proportions of how many doctors and nurses are available before and after are like insanely different, right? So you have so much work put in. Then you have something like in the 30s already, you're developing resort science, like how to create resorts, like kurortologia, right? Kurorts, like you've already had this from the beginning. They're investing their money into how to create these, use like natural healing to encourage healing of people. They take the most cutting edge science back then and they take the wealth, like what the wealthiest people had access to, and they try to make them for everyone, you know? So you see it from the beginning. Now, how much all of this was able to be, because you still have like, it seems like, right, you have housing for just for the doctors and nurses. And then once you get them, then you do for the teachers, you know, so it's slowly expanding of how much with capacity. But the tendency is to increase it. So it's not just like for the elites. They'll always try to say, oh, this is for the KGB elite, it's for the nomenclatura, but it's just not true. They're constantly improving access for everyone, with everything from cars to housing to resorts to whatever, vacations. It's just that this entire project comes to a halt.
Mm-hmm.
So we've no idea what it was going to be like, what could have been. Because then you have the cooperatives and so on that just steal everything from the coffers of the Soviet Union just and accelerate its downfall. So how much it was being used, how much every single law, I don't know. I have to look at every single thing about, like, say, even, you know, housing standards, so on. But in general, it seems like, even though they'll say, like, I'll have this debates with my family members and so on, and they'll be like, oh, you know how much money we have to pay to put this guy into school, you know, university? And I'm like, but everyone went to something. So it means that there was room for everyone. You know, like, you just paid for top spot for a much more elite thing, but nobody was left out. So it's not like there was only education for the rich or something, or for the nomenclatura, or you had to pay bribes. Everyone had it. And everybody says, if you were smart enough, you didn't have to pay bribes. That's always a joke. Like, oh no, I was actually a good student, I didn't have to pay a bribe. It's like, that's like a common thing people will say. Oh no, I didn't have to pay bribes. And so this is like, yes, there was, and I think Georgia is one of the most corrupt in that sense, right? Briberies and so on. It was like very, very let loose. But even with that, you still had it working, you know, for the poor.
Yeah.
Even with that.
Definitely. One of my, and I have to be personal, one of my memories growing up in Soviet Armenia was going with my grandparents to these resorts, going to these resorts, and all the vacation that everyone had, like mandatory vacation, something that even in the US, even middle-class people probably don't have access to. So to finish this section, I want to urge our listeners to check out Sopo's podcast, Reimagining Soviet Georgia. You can Google it. I believe it's available on Spotify as well as other platforms.
And we have the links in the show notes.
Definitely. Please give it a try. I found it very addictive. I listened through several episodes in one shot. So I'm sure you'll find a lot of interesting material there.
Thank you so much.
Hey, folks. We want to take a little break and ask you how you're liking this show and the rest of our shows. If you are a fan, then we would appreciate your support. podcast.groom.org/donate. We have talked about this in the past, and we will use all the donations to improve our reach. We believe that our word needs to get out. And if you agree with us, please consider supporting us. You see from this podcast with Sopo and from other podcasts that we do try to cover a variety of opinions, a variety of topics, and we really want to do more of this. And your help greatly matters in doing this.
Hovig, it's not so much about the money that we are talking about here, but it's about the kind of effort that we put into this show. There's a lot of information and disinformation out there. And at Grung, we're trying to bring 100% factual and balanced analysis and discussions to our listeners. The issue is that it takes a lot of time and effort to produce these shows, and we love doing this. We're not going to stop doing this simply because we don't have external help. But if we are able to find the kind of help that we need, we would be able to concentrate a lot more of our efforts into making more of these discussions and putting it out for you. What we hear from listeners often is ideas who to talk to and what discussions and what topics they'd like to hear. But there are so many hours in our day, we can only get to so many shows at a time. But if we had help, if we can expand our outreach, then we would be able to do more of this coverage.
So if you're a fan of true media that is grassroots, that is not influenced by foreign geopolitical powers or any foreign powers, then, and if it's fully supported by our listeners, then go ahead and give us a try and give us some support. podcast.grung.org/donate. We would prefer if you could sign up for support. And there are three categories: the Surge sponsor for $5 a month, Lahmacun Luminary for $10 a month, and the most generous one, Harissa Humanitarian, $25 a month. But you could just as well buy us a coffee and use that mechanism to give us support. But we would like recurring donations as a show of your continuing support. And it helps us in planning our show and planning our expenses a little bit better.
Yeah. Pick your favorite sustaining membership through podcasts.grung.org/donate.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go back to our show. We're talking with Sopo Japarite. Let's turn our attention to some current events. A year ago, in March 2023, the Georgian government introduced a so-called foreign agent bill in parliament, but a wave of protests forced them to withdraw the bill. Earlier this year, I think in the last month or two, the bill was reintroduced, and last week the Georgian parliament passed it into law. The bill is similar to the U.S. Foreign Agent Registration Act, commonly known as FARA, and there are similar bills around European countries as well. The Georgian bill mandates that NGOs that receive more than 20% of their funding from foreign sources be registered as organizations, quote, pursuing the interests of a foreign power, unquote. And unlike the U.S. law, the Georgian law doesn't foresee any criminal punishments, just fines. It's hard to cut through all the hype and extreme language around this issue. The government talks about the Maidanization of Georgia, while the opponents, which is primarily the West, talks about the loss of democracy, Russification, etc. So what are the key sensitivities around this bill, Sopo?
It's really difficult because I just like look at what's happening and I think it's like kind of like mass hysteria because the bill, though it's bad, it like should not have elicited this much so that you have the biggest protests ever in the history of Georgia, you know, happening over this. So it's really interesting how this something I consider much smaller has seemed to be translated into such a dire existential crisis where people are convinced, and I'm talking about like people who are involved in the protests, and I'm still trying to study the anatomy of the class composition of the protests because everything in me says they're mostly middle class. Like the people who are really affected by the foreign money are kind of middle class people. And really, because the big capitalists are with the government. You know, it really is sort of like the petit bourgeoisie and the middle classes that are sort of fighting it. But again, I'm still trying to study. I don't have a lot of the data to confirm anything I'm saying. This is my thesis that was involved. And so from the beginning, the opposition back then with UNM only pretty much until all these other little parties had formed, they were trying to push that Georgian Dream was a Russian project, you know? And so even like I've seen EU Parliament, like their people in EU Parliament also state such things in earliest, I think 2012, I want to say, as a Russian project, but it didn't really get a lot of traction. They just kept pushing it. And they started really getting a lot of traction like 2019 with Gavrilov. It's like this thing happened where it's also another ridiculous thing that brought out so many people. It's like they had some kind of inter-parliamentary Orthodox Church event at the parliament that has nothing to do with parliament. It was just like in some kind of Orthodox Church thing where Gavrilov, a Russian MP and a communist, sat in a chair because he was chairing, because it was like it was had they had turns every like year who would chair, and it was like Gavrilov's turn. It just so happened, and he sat in a chair of the parliament speaker because it was a parliament, it was kind of like a rented hallway, right?
Yeah,
and so he sat in the chair. Yeah, he sat in the chair because that's he's the chair of this like
session,
Orthodox thing. And then they were able to politicize this and say some Russian was sitting in the parliament, you know, some kind of Russian takeover, which it seemed like really took off, and crazy to me how that was interpreted in such dire, you know, you could say it's uncomfortable. I don't want that, you know, many things. You could say Georgian Dream should have been more sensitive to how things could appear because it's such a very anti-Russian kind of, you know, fears and so on. But it was just did not merit that kind of level of outrage. But that's just how I feel about a lot of things. Like, I just does not translate into how this is like being understood. And so this affluence bill is not quite like FARA because it's mandatory to register everyone. So FARA is more like they will choose, right? So it's even though this, they will lie in Georgia, including Americans, will say it's nothing like if American government will lie. It's nothing like FARA because FARA apparently does not go after NGOs. That's just a lie. They do go after NGOs. They do go after media like Russia Today, Al Jazeera, you know. So, but they choose to do it. Like they will choose to start a process against someone they don't like, which is different than in Georgia. Everyone has to be registered. But then there's the Georgian version would be fines, while the FARA version is like convictions and like, you know, jail. So also different risks and
different and, balances.
Punishments. Yeah.
I found the term pursuing the interests of a foreign power may be a little inflammatory, to be honest. I mean,
absolutely.
If I were working for one of these organizations and I have to, it's like an admission in court that I'm working for another country. And that's not necessarily true if 20% of my funding is coming from there. But I thought it was strange that something that could have maybe been worked out in the guts of the bill elicited a response from the people that is more akin to like the government signing the dissolution of the country or something. You know, the response was so extreme.
Or handing off key territories of a country to another country, like in Armenia. But let me ask you this question, and also feel free to answer, and I don't want to interrupt, but do you personally feel that there is a necessity for something like this law that was being brought up? And so do you think that the difference, the problem is in the technicalities, or should maybe just they have basically avoided bringing this law altogether?
Yeah, so I think there's absolutely a need for transparency for the people, like for people to be able to see. But this bill is just not for that, even though I find it very interesting because the NGOs have been saying their defense has been, we are transparent. We send our declarations to the government. It's like they never think that transparency shouldn't be for the government. It should be for the people. I found this really, really fascinating. They never even think about why should we show anything to the people? It's like, what do they deserve? We only send it to the government if we have to, and to our donors. Like, screw the people. So I definitely think not just NGOs, lobbyists, business. Like, we have been fighting for media, business right, to be transparent for a long time. And so that has not happened. Like business, I mean, there has actually, I would say there has been some regulations for business to be transparent, to show some profits and so on. There has been some moves. But in general, there's something called the business secrets that guard against us being able to see what business is doing. Especially imagine your union, you are asking for, say, raises in wages, and the company's like, we don't have the money. And you're like, don't know how to check that. and they won't give it to you, which is like in other places where you have collective, you know, bargain negotiations, you know, the profit. So you can say, yeah, actually you do have the money for this. So really, as far as transparency, every single level is guilty, you know, or not, or needs work. And so there's business, there's lobbying, there's also so many free trade agreements and things we signed that we don't know about, you know, like, and so everything needs this work. So it is like, why would you start with NGOs only, right? It does seem, this is where it's like the government is clearly targeting NGOs and media, but they're really clearly targeting what what we're saying, our thesis is, there's a few of these that are their enemies that have way more access and privilege and money than everyone else, that control a lot of politics and how Georgian Dream is seen internationally, right? So they're really trying to target these few institutions. And I have to say, using the word NGO is ridiculous. These are like huge institutions that have tons of money and pretty much are asked to review Georgian Dream and all rankings and, you know, like putting together reports and so on. So they're not like me, you know, like we're a union that doesn't have much power. They're, you know, we're not even the same league. There's tons of NGOs that have no power at all. It's really these main ones that determine a lot of politics and how Georgian Dream is being used. Like I was just looking at rankings. It was some kind of open budget rankings. And they were like, we made these rankings. And I scrolled down and they were like, we made these rankings according to the information provided by Transparency Georgia. You know, it's like these are the things that are not talked about, right? And then it comes off like, oh, we don't know this. But it's like every kind of freedom ranking, this ranking, and of course, Georgian Dream, very much so, is obsessed with rankings. If you studied them from the beginning, the first 5 years, they would just say, look at our ranking on doing business. Look at our ranking. Like they just kept saying that. Like that was the only politics they had. Just look at our rankings, you know? So if you are this huge institutions that are able to influence how Georgian Dream and everybody else, I'm sorry, nobody cares about quality data or assessments or how what SOPO thinks or what who thinks. They look at the metrics, right? What number is it on this? What number is it on that? You know, and that's how they go, oh, so this country is semi-authoritarian or whatever, you know, it's like, no, you shouldn't do business there. And Georgian Dream is very much aware of this. And this is why they've become sort of obsessed, I would say, with trying to curtail the power of these institutions. And these institutions often are connected to opposition political parties, you know, also like everyone knows if you want a party, but you can't get direct money, you just create a bullshit NGO and you funnel money through that. Like, come on, like we know this stuff, like, you know, like there's tricks and stuff that, you know, as an NGO that they do. I mean, I was shocked at first when I was called to defend these two lawyers in a LGBT NGO, that the director was stealing all their money. All the money that was supposed to be given as wages, he was telling them to give them back to him. And he was building a house for his mother. You know, so it's like, I know like how you can manipulate some of these things. But now it's like, if you talk to him about it, everyone's like, no, NGOs are like pure and good and nothing like this happens. And, you know, it's just like fantasy land of what they're kind of creating.
Yeah.
So why was the bill brought back now? Is there something special about this moment in time, do you think?
Yeah. So again, I think, and this is a conjecture, you know, so I was really confused for the first week. I think I was so confused why they brought this back, because I really didn't think this was going to come back. And then I started looking at it, that at the same time, European Union and US have decided they can use the percentage of frozen funds to give to Ukraine. So the head of the European Bank was like, we're kind of shaking up the entire international financial system by doing this, right? So because it's very, very political what they're doing. And it's this sort of pure system that's kept, that you know you have trust in, because capitalism is all about making sure you guard your private property, right? If that is, all the laws are around that, keep your private property to make sure one doesn't steal from the other, right?
Right.
Those are the rules. And then all of a sudden you have this hyper, like a EU, US against Russia and China. It's like, it's constantly going up and up and up, this like temperature. And so the EU and US are making these moves to that are jeopardizing the sort of so supposedly this neutral international financial system by going after frozen accounts. And at the same time, you have the US sanctioning judges, Georgian judges last year, because of NGOs saying these judges were corrupt and the courts were corrupt and the Georgian Dream was not doing anything about it. So, and then you have Georgian Dream being like, we actually have European like human rights courts agreeing with the judges that were Georgian against the specific case. So they're like keeping like, we're asking US to give us an explanation why are these judges sanctioned when they have been shown to have been non-biased and they have actually made decisions that were correct, right?
Yeah, that is terrifying.
Right, exactly. Yes. So the Georgian Dream oligarch, right, the guy who funds all this, is looking at this. He already knows about this way before I did, right? Because he has all these people probably paying attention to the money. And he already had problems with Swiss credit, you know, Swiss bank that like froze his accounts and had all his issues and took him to court. He's looking at this and he's like, so there's these institutions that have tons of power that can actually tell the US or EU who to sanction. And no matter what we say, they believe them over us. And at the same time, so the sanctions are could be arbitrary. And then second, if you sanction or freeze the accounts, they can use them against you. So as a you know oligarch who is the party who needs this oligarch's money, you're going to start being like, wait, I got to limit the power of these NGOs, these institutions that are trying to threaten me, who are rogue. And I need to safeguard my money to make sure that in this, he also has like offshore law that they passed to make sure that my money's safe from them. And this is why I think happened. And they kept saying, and if this is true, and I don't know why they would lie, clearly, Georgian Dream had spoken to U.S. and other donors saying you're funding these people who are not always correctly assessing us. They treat us like the enemy no matter what we do, right? Even when we don't do anything wrong, whatever, I'm assuming. Because you see these like comment statements by Georgian Dream to the U.S. and EU in ways that are like, why aren't you having these private discussions? Like, clearly, that has been already unable to be done. So you're having these like public comments that you would have never had a couple of years ago, because you would have had direct line. And so I can imagine the frustration in this. And yet the opposition and everyone else does not take any of this into account. They don't care. They think this is a lie. You know, they think they're correct. This is a Russian controlled government. And like the leftist rhetoric has been like some rich guy, you know, oligarch sold his country for billions of dollars and he only cares about his money, right? Like nothing but national interests, really about him, but his money. And the opposition really wants, and they keep every single thing that's been going on right now. This is why they also raised a lot of like noise. They're begging the EU and US to sanction the oligarch now. And when there was O'Brien from like the Secretary of State's assistant,
yeah.
He was like, we might sanction. Like, and they were like, yes, exactly. So I think part of it was to raise a lot of the heat now is to get him sanctioned. Why is it important? Because elections are coming up. And guess what? If the oligarch doesn't have his money, he could be defeated.
Makes sense. Nevertheless, the possibility that an NGO that is already receiving foreign funding can pass on information to a foreign government to sanction citizens of a country seems like, I mean, I don't think that has been used against Armenian individuals yet, but I guess that's what is in our future if we misbehave.
Exactly.
Or we just don't know that it's going on.
Yeah. I mean, we know that there have been some sanctions, but I think it was in your last podcast that I heard one of your guests say that this is now a up-and-coming tactic of US and other sort of institutions where they will ask the NGOs to give them lists of people to sanction. So completely extrajudiciary, completely literally foreign influenced, you know, behavior targeting the citizens of a country.
Yep. It's like the things, measures that were used for extreme like wars and stuff were now being used in a regular situation. But even the, like, the way this has been treated is like that we had foreign ministers come to Georgia and lead and like speak to the protests. And they kept showing pictures when this happened 2008 during the Russian invasion. I'm like, you understand, like, this is not a war situation, right? So like, why are you in our country having this huge perks of speaking to all these people, foreigners, like foreign ministers, right? Inciting against Georgian dreams, also saying that, oh, we shouldn't just call this a Russian law, we should call it a Putin law, like just really pushing more and more crazy anti-Russian, anti-Putin kind of politics that are already there, but even worse. And then, of course, they're seeing this, oh, these Westerners are confirming everything we're saying, so of course this must be true. And then you had some other stupid expat on, like, Twitter being like, Elon Musk, give them, like, his internet that he gave to Ukraine.
The Starlink, yes.
Starlink. I'm just like, this isn't a war situation. Like, this is not a war. Like, they're treating it like a second front has opened.
Right.
It's wild. It's wild to see all this.
It really does feel like it's a geopolitical tug of war. In Ukraine, it's a hot war. In Georgia, in Armenia, it's more of a, it's not a cold war, but it's a, how to say it, it's more of a civil war, let's call it. Mm-hmm. What we're talking about is basically the weaponizing of the financial institution, the worldwide financial institution, to be able to sanction anybody around the world for arbitrary reasons. Like Hovik said, it's terrifying.
Yeah. And it's like, they could just say you're Russian and you're Chinese or something, and that's it. You're done. Yeah. Like, it's crazy.
And just one more comment on the NGOization. I honestly, yes, I do believe that not all NGOs are bad per se, but the biggest ones, the ones who receive the lion's share of funding and support from the West, it seems like just like in Georgia, in Armenia as well, are ones that not only implement projects that supposedly help people, but they have clear geopolitical guidance. For instance, one of these major ones in Armenia is called the Union of Informed Citizens. The name Daniel Ioannisyan is, when you say that, people summon up like, you know, images of this devil coming up. I don't know, at least I do. But what they're doing now is, because geopolitically Armenia is in a very tight spot because the West is saying, you know, you should not have relations with Russia, you should not have relations with Iran. So this NGO, which normally fights for LGBT rights, which normally fights for, you know, transparency in the court system and so forth, started producing anti-Iranian videos. And if that's not a clear example of how this is, these tools are being used, these tools are being weaponized geopolitically, I don't know what else it could be. So, yeah, that's my own opinion about NGOs. And I hope that one day an Armenian law could also be implemented, although maybe a little bit better in terms of technicalities, but, you know, what remains to be seen what happens. And last question, do you believe that, I believe the president said that they would veto this law. Do you believe that there is enough votes in the parliament to override the veto?
Yes, there are enough votes to override the veto, but Georgian Dream reps have kind of said they're open to amendments to harmonize this with the EU laws or EU maybe future laws that they want to also enact against NGOs, their own foreign influence. They pretty much banned all Russian. Like, so it's interesting because EU just completely thinks that it's totally fine to be ridiculously authoritarian as long as it's Russia, right? It's like Russia, China, totally fine. It's nothing about principles of, you know, democracy and stuff, but it's the fact that it's here. It's like they were mostly angry that it was like EU would be considered a foreign influence and they want to be influenced by EU. They think the foreign influence, foreign agents should only be Russian or Chinese. And this, China is not really a big actor, but Russia for sure. And so I think in general, the government made gestures that they're willing to open, you know, to talk to talks with that. But the Georgian president said, oh, I'm not going to do anything to help them out. You are, they said, there's this law is going to stay Russian just like you are. You know, I'm not going to try to help you in that. So who knows what's going to happen? Definitely the president's going to try to veto it. I don't know if they're going to try to overturn it or come up with a new law that's different. But the Venice Commission's also, they're waiting on this appraisal of this law that should be coming in next week. Also what that says, if the language supports the Georgian Dream government, it'll be a huge win for them. The language is against them, there'll be another proof that this law will drive away from the EU and drive Georgia towards the embrace of Russia, which is like how they're claiming this. They don't believe Georgia could ever have its own national interests ever. They can never, for them, it's just two camps, you know, one or the other.
So as I understand, actually, if Zurabishvili decides to veto, the parliament only needs really a simple majority. And they've already basically passed the law with 84 out of 150 yes. votes. So they have the numbers if they want it. But like you said, I do hope that they work out the language. Language can certainly be better and that maybe all sides will be happy. But one quick thing, Sopo.
I don't think the opposition will take any
compromise
version of this. No, not at all.
I'm not going to argue with that because I believe that that is probably true, unfortunately. There's one point that I want to dwell on for just a moment, Sopo. It was interesting to note how the Western media was flooded with the coverage of these events in Georgia. I follow a lot of news sources. Voice of America, for example, was going at the rate of one or two articles about Georgia a month. And now they have 2 to 4 articles a day with pictures, with human stories and police brutality and things like that. It's just overwhelming amount of attention onto these protests. What is the domestic coverage of this in Georgia?
So all the channels besides the pro-government channel, right? There's a couple. Every single media is with the opposition. So you only see everything. They all have the same stories too. It's like, I was kind of like, if I was a Western donor, I would just give one money. This, it's like they give all these media money and they all show the same thing. You know, it's like, so they show the same thing as you're saying, human stories, this, that, every kind of same joke, every kind of like mocking, every kind of same explanations. It's all the same. It's all the same. All you do is you hear protests. Now today was like anti-gay, like it was pretty much family purity day, right? Huge protests, huge rally of Georgians coming in, conservative protests. That's also pro-government. Let's go. Government forces have been able to sort of coexist with it. Not a lot of coverage. All right, it's just been like now all of a sudden they're interested. What is a family? You know, it's just you never see any of this kind of deep reflections about families and how people are struggling in Georgia, unless it has to do with some kind of against the Georgian dream, right? And it's like same thing with sovereignty. You could have had these discussions. Like I have always been urging discussions of what does sovereignty mean, right? Georgian Dream didn't want to have those conversations. The opposition doesn't want to have those. No one wanted to have those conversations. They're just, but now certain conversations are being forced, but they're only being articulated in a way that fits a certain kind of political goal. And so it's just see how trash our media is really. It's just like, and they all tell each other it's really great. They all like, oh, you're so brave and heroes for going to these protests and like, oh, seeing the police brutality and being pepper sprayed. You know, it's like, and like, oh, it's so, you're such great heroes. And it's like back and forth telling each other how great they are and how they're these freedom fighters. You have to see this crazy statement by the media. Like, let me just read it to you because it's so biased that I cannot believe that they actually thought this was like, okay. It was something like, it's in my newsletter. Like, Russia is the teacher of Georgian dream. Like, this is how it starts. But it's signed by almost every single media. It's like, how is this media, right? How is this, like, this is all just like Fox News or like MSNBC, right? It's like, that's all it is. And then it ends with, we must go return back to Europe. Our return back. So it's very ideological. And so you were like, how could this be media that I can actually trust, right? Because it is insanely biased. Then you have like another media where the former ambassador, U.S. ambassador, sharing, being like, this is the best media in Georgia, you should all listen to it. And it's like, there were a couple of years ago, they were literally arguing, pretty much asking for the West to intervene in Georgia. And I was like, this is embarrassing what I'm reading. They wrote an editor letter pretty much asking for the Western intervention. This is a media. And so then you have like layers and layers of just, to me, like incredibly unprofessional behavior and unethical in that sense. Like, you should, like, our union, like, we have positions, we have all these things that, but like, as far as, say, members, like, we accept all ideologies. Like, you know, it's like, as a worker, you have tons of different ideas. Like, there's certain things we'll say, expect that we can, you know, take positions on that have to do with union work or social policies or whatever. But like, I would never force every single member to have a certain ideology. Like, you have to accept like Russia is the evil that you have to, or whatever the West is this. And so it's like, why, when in the US, we always have this problem of organizations always wanting to be neutral, you know, like not wanting to take positions. We have the opposite here. It's like everyone is obsessively politicized and willing to share all the time their political ideas, including like UN Georgia should not be making political comments, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
So, Sopo, let's turn our attention to our final topic, which is Armenian-Georgian relations, but from a high level. We've discussed Armenian-Georgian relations with Georgian colleagues earlier this year. We talked to Dato Darciashvili, Arshil Siharulidze. We always like to ask about this one thing. Georgians and Armenians have a huge amount of similarity and affinity with each other. Both are indigenous to the Caucasus. Both are Eastern Orthodox Christian nations. Our elites have intermingled for centuries, and we don't have a history of real enmity. Why are we not better friends and allies and maybe so-called brother or sister nations? We are acquaintances, but not friends. We are cordial, but not warm. Why do you think this is?
Yeah, this is a little harder than the other questions.
And that doesn't apply between us, and me and Hovik.
Yeah,
but nationally, that's how it works out for some reason.
I think Georgians, they want to look towards the West. You know, Armenia is to the east of them. And I think that in general, like, they know what's going on in Berlin, you know, like more than they know what's going on in Yerevan. When I visited Yerevan, like, Armenians were shocked that Georgian has come. They're like, we all go to Tbilisi, but no Georgian ever comes the other way, you know? And so I do think that it's kind of like working class people. They'll have more middle class as the aspirational and not so much other workers. So I get the sense the same thing in the Caucasus, especially next to us. Like, we don't want to be associated so much and forge such deep relations with Armenia. We kind of want to forge relationships with EU. It's like they're trying to get places. Like, Georgia is ambitious, you know, sort of a, I think of in some ways like petit bourgeois, like nation, like a consciousness nation. It's always trying to climb up. You can't really associate with people on your level because you want to go higher up. And that would require like some kind of Armenian Georgian relationship, require a deeper kind of like politics and a understanding of your nation, right? So you would want, like, for me, like, if I said this like the other day, and it's like, if you hate your boss, you can either organize with your workers and win some things and, you know, fight for sort of more democracy at the workplace and get better, you know, kind of contracts, this and that, or you can leave and start a small business. And so I think it's like this. We are the type that want to leave and start our own business. We don't want to forge relationships with other people like us. And so I want to imagine like what Georgia would look like if it had different politics of trying to ally themselves with the people that are more oppressed or people who are like them, right? Because even with our votes, you can see, like, with Israel, like, we, it was Palestine, the last vote, like, Georgia voted, abstained from Palestine being admitted into the, we're trying to pin our movements to the, you know, Israel, to Hungary told us to help us in EU, to US, what you US wants from us. And they think that Armenians are pro-Russians, right? So that's another element. They don't want to be associated with pro-Russians. Right. And they also blame...
Yeah, how big is that element? Because from previous discussions, it seems like, you know, all the media propaganda aside, there seems to be a visceral fear, antagonism against Russia in Georgia. And I want to understand that a little bit better, because as an Armenian, for instance, as a survivor, you know, as a grandchild of genocide survivors, I do have that visceral fear of Turkey, especially in today's policies, especially when Turkish parliamentarians go into the parliament and say, we got to finish the job that Enver Pasha started and so forth in 1915. I don't think Russians have such a long history of, I mean, that I don't want to minimize the war that happened. I don't want to minimize the antagonism between Russians and Georgians. But for me, it doesn't seem as historical and as ingrained in our DNA.
It's not genocidal either.
Well, I mean, I will let a Georgian say that, you know, but maybe they do view it as genocidal. Why do Georgians consider Russia as their biggest threat? I mean, the war and all the past, you know, over the last 20 years, all the conflict notwithstanding.
I don't know. I mean, I do know and I don't know, you know, so I can point to the fact that it's like politics are 20% of my country's occupied, but, you know, by Russia, that's like the talking point all the time you hear, despite the fact that Abkhazians, Ossetians exist and they are erased completely from the picture. It looks upon as like only a war between Georgia and Russia. And it's like those are just Georgian lands that were just taken by Russia, not that other people also live there and they have some de facto independence with it's or whatever, certain autonomy. I don't know how much autonomy. I haven't studied them in depth, so I can't tell you. But clearly they seem to have some kind of autonomy within the Russian Federation. And so it's every single politics has been framed in a much sort of more complex issues have been framed much more simplistically, you know, so it's like occupation, that's bad, you know, occupied your land. There's, you know, they will claim like 200 years, they'll say, of colonization, because I think the Soviet Union is not a, what I consider Georgian, very much a Georgian developed project. They'll say that's Russian occupation. Soviet occupation is the same thing as Russian occupation. Some guy was trying to make a case that like Stalin was a Russian agent. I was like, what kind of eyes do you even look at this, the world? Like, it's so rewritten and revised the history of they teach these kids and these people. It's like crazy, right? Even like if you hear the both the government and the opposition, like their rhetoric is that they were trying to take away our language in 1970s. Also not true. They were trying to also safeguard other languages alongside Georgian, but that is looked upon as taking away only exclusively Georgian that should be allowed, right? So it's just heavily revised. Now you can say, I argue, of course, that there was Russian Empire from 1800 to 1917, right? But even within that, we can make arguments that Georgian king allied with Russia to safeguard certain territories from other invaders. They chose the Christians to instead of the Muslim invaders, right? So there's like certain things I can make arguments. To make arguments how the first decades, the Russian of viceroy was really harsh. And in 1830s, all the Georgian feudal lords were about to like kill all the Russians, like assassinate them, you know? So and then, of course, another viceroy comes in and just is able to sort of woo them and charm them and then calm down the aristocracy. And then they become super loyal to the Russian Empire and then try to take out the Chechens for them. You know, so it's like there's so many layers and layers and layers. Mm-hmm. And then really the ruling classes were tied much more with Russian Empire. It was really the working class, the social democrats that are fighting against Russian Empire, who now are demonized same way as Soviet Union is somehow Russian Empire. So there's so many layers we can talk about, but there's definitely a nationalist history that is being taught. And the center stage of that is Russia, you know, like the world ends, every kind of imagination is only looked upon as in the, through the eyes of Russia. So how Armenians feel about Turks, even though there really is no genocide the same way there was Armenian genocide by Turkey. I would say, I mean, I don't even know, I don't know about Armenian discourse, but I would say maybe even worse fears of Russia than maybe Armenians of Turkey, you know? So
how do Georgians view Turkey?
Yeah, and to be more precise, and maybe I don't want to lead you, but yeah, I would really love to know, because of the status quo we have, for instance, in Ajaria, where, you know, we hear that huge swaths of businesses are taken over by Turkish entrepreneurs. Do Georgians see a threat from that at all, or do they purely see it again from that lens of Russia versus, you know, everything else? So do they see it as a counterbalance to Russia, as a net positive force?
So I would say regular people actually don't like Turkey, or at least are afraid of the Muslim sort of, because during the anti-dam protesters, there was definitely fear that the Muslims will come, because it was a Turkish company, and settle there, you know? So, and especially if you go to Acara, where it's like a lot of Turkish people and then like businesses, there's definitely more, I would say more conservative nationalist Georgians have more fear of Turkey, and they like Russia more because they feel culturally close to the Christian, you know, Russians. And they understand them, you know, it's like they get Russians, they don't get Turkish people. But the ruling ideology is to hate Russia and love Turkey because of NATO and pro-West, right? So it depends. If, like, even during during the anti-dam protesters, that they were afraid of Turkey, like the regular people were saying this, or the conservative, you know, there, a lot of them are conservative naturally. You heard the same liberals argue that these were xenophobes, that the only reason they didn't like the dam was actually because they were afraid that the dam would destroy their entire valley, but not because of that, because they were just xenophobes against Turkish people. So that's what they kept pushing all the opposition parties, besides actually UNM, which they kind of did it differently. They were like, yeah, power to the, you know, dam, anti-dam protesters. So it's like, it depends. They really are trying to push a pro-Azeri, pro-Turkey line, the ruling elites. And that has been because of the NATO and pro-West. Because Azerbaijan is liked by Turkeys, despite the fact that they hate Erdogan, they have all this, like, call him authoritarian and stuff. He's still, like, closer to their guy, right?
Mm.
But, you know, I have to say that as a diasporan, I consider myself a Western Armenian and a speaker of Western Armenian. I look on this issue through a slightly different lens. For me, the Eastern or Western cultural orientation is not divided along this geopolitical Russia versus the West line. In fact, I consider Russia as part of Europe. For me, what really attaches Armenians to Europe today is that, and I have a couple of reasons. First of all, our pre-Soviet writers and intelligentsia were mostly educated in Europe and brought European and Enlightenment values to the Armenians of Istanbul and Western Armenia, starting around 200 years ago with people like Khachaturabovyan. And second, as it comes to today, two-thirds of our nation has lived in the diaspora for over 100 years now, mostly in Europe and the U.S., the West, but also Russia since the Soviet Union.
But I find that kind of fascinating, how Armenia is able to have both directions in some ways, right? Like, it's...
That's true, yeah.
Because it's the diaspora of Armenian diaspora is way big, longer than we ever had. We just started having diaspora. Mm-hmm. So you have all these people in the West, Armenians, who are not this kind of, Cold War mentality. They don't have it. Well, there's developing, it seems like now. They don't have it like as much as Georgians do. And so that is a very interesting phenomena to me, how Armenians can sort of balance and sort of pick and choose a lot more than I feel like Georgians, at least admit it. Like, Georgians may do it, but not admit it, you know, like.
That's interesting that you say we can pick and choose, because I feel like we're between a rock and a hard place and have no choices. Politically, super dependent upon Russia, but in a sense, culturally, always eyeing what's going on in Europe.
Yeah, well,
different perspectives on the same reality, let's say.
Tough times.
All right. So we're going to leave it there for today. This was a fascinating conversation. Thank you, Sopo, for coming on the show. We look forward to keeping this dialogue open with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Sopo.
I hope we cooperate again the next time. And good luck with your show.
And you as well.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.
That's our show today. This episode was recorded on May 17, 2024. We've been talking with Sopo Japaridze, who is the chair of Solidarity Network, an independent care workers union in Georgia. She's been a labor organizer for over a decade. She researches and studies labor and social relations and writes for various publications. She is a co-founder of the Reimagining Soviet Georgia podcast. Please remember to support us. Go to our donate page, podcasts.gruung.org/donate, and become a sustaining member of Gruung and give monthly. Thank you in advance. I'm Asbet Bedrosyan.
And this is Hovik Manucharyan.
Please follow us on social media and follow us everywhere you get your Armenian news. The links are in the show notes. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you soon.